Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Jeff Hawkins of the Integrative Health Studies Program at Northern New Mexico College. Right now, I'd like to welcome Lorelei Novak. She is with the Northern New Mexico Citizens Advisory Board and is here to talk to us about the not very oft talked about subject of nuclear waste at Los Alamos National Laboratories. Welcome.
Okay. Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
It's good to have you, and it's good to have you back. We've had you on the show before talking about this, the whole subject of nuclear waste and how it affects the rest of New Mexico outside the boundaries of LANL, of Los Alamos National Laboratories, because, of course, water flows.
That's right.
What is the situation that we have right now? We're actually here to talk about an event that's happening tonight on a nuclear waste dump site at the lab.
That's right. There's a big decision to be made about this radioactive mixed waste landfill that's coming up in the near future regarding closure of the site. It's called Material Disposal Area G. It's located at Technical Area 54. It's about 60 acres. It's right by Pajarita Road, next door neighbor to the San Ildefonso Pueblo. And there's two big options that are being considered.
Well, hang on. What is the site like? In other words, it's a 60-acre site with barrels of nuclear waste in it, buried
well,
in the ground? What's going on there?
It's got pits and trenches that have nuclear low-level mixed hazardous waste that is buried. And on top of that sits drums of true waste that is slated to go to WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in Carlsbad. So that would have to be, of course, removed first, and then we deal with the actual waste. And there's the idea of designing an engineered cap and covering it and continue aggressive monitoring around the site, because it does sit above the regional aquifer. The aquifer is about 800 feet down. And
Got nuclear waste sitting on top of an aquifer in New Mexico, and you're trying to decide what to do with it.
That's right, because it has to be closed. It's part of the consent order, the cleanup process for the laboratory. And the other option would be complete excavation of the site, which is huge. Both options are kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. They each have major pros and cons.
So you call the two options cap or carry.
That's right.
So either you put a cap on top of it and seal it for all time, or you take it away.
That's right. It would go somewhere else. But that would involve a lot of trucks. At our dry run for our forum tonight, the folks at LANL stated that it may well be on the order of about 50 trucks per day removing waste for the next 25 years to completely excavate the site.
50 trucks a day for the next 25 years to excavate the amount of nuclear waste that is in this 60-acre site.
That's right.
And so that's one option. And the other is to
design this engineered cap, which there's a lot of technology that goes into this. It covers the waste. The waste is left in place, and it looks like natural grasses. And then there's monitoring all around the perimeter of the site, monitoring wells. There's many different ways to monitor it to make sure it's not leaking. But it has to be taken in consideration that this is long-term monitoring, 100 years, 1,000 years. All this has to be taken in consideration.
Now, the fact is that nuclear, no matter where you put it, it's going to be radioactive somewhere.
That's right.
And so you either leave it here or take it away. And tonight there's going to be actually a public education forum where people will be talking about these alternatives that you were telling our listeners about. It's at the Santa Fe Community College in the Jemez complex.
That's right.
That's in the main building of the...
Yeah, and there's signs that point you back to the Jemez rooms. There'll be expert presentations, question and answer. Our board is chartered to really involve the public in this decision. We want to get them early on in the process, get the public educated as to what's involved with both of these options so that they can provide informed public comment, be involved in this decision-making process, because it really does affect the citizens of Northern New Mexico. This is their decision in a way, and once there's a process that goes through, there's a corrective measures evaluation where LANL says, this is what's going on at the site, this is what we suggest. Then the state comes in, issues a statement of basis, and they say, okay, well, this is what we want to do. That's where the public comes in. That's where they can provide their comment and say, no, we prefer cap, or we prefer, you know, carry. Then the state issues their final remedy, and they said, this is what we're going to do. But
so tonight is from 4 to 6, people will be sort of hanging around, and then from 6 to 7:30, there are going to be people from LANO, from the Department of Energy, and from San Ildefonso Pueblo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then from at 7:45 to 9 o'clock, there will be questions from the public for the presenters. Mm-hmm. Is tonight the main time that the public can comment, or is that coming up?
Yeah, this is early on in the process. We want to start this education process now. The statement of basis, where the public has the chance to comment through the State Environment Department, is coming up later this year.
Okay.
But we can't stress enough that the more you know about these options, it's very complex. It's hard to describe. We're going to have subject matter experts, diagrams. We're going to have color-coded options and risk. And the board wants to gather public comments so that they may, in fact, make a recommendation to the Department of Energy, which is part of our charter.
So you're with a unusual group called the Northern New Mexico Citizens Advisory Board, which is actually chartered by the United States Department of Energy, and whose purpose is?
The purpose is to make formal recommendations to the Department of Energy on issues of environmental remediation and waste management at the lab.
Okay. There are so specifically, it's all about the lab.
Yeah, and the board members are volunteer-appointed board members that represent a cross-section of the community. So that's this whole thing was started by the Federal Advisory Committee Act that established these boards at the main nuclear sites across the country so that the citizens can have an impact in these decisions.
It sounds almost like democracy.
Yeah, in a way. We hope.
We're talking to Lorelei Novak. Okay, so people can show up tonight as early as 4 o'clock, but things are really getting underway at 6 o'clock at the Jemez Room in the Santa Fe Community College. And the whole event will go until 9 o'clock, including the questions for the presenters at the end. And the presenters are people who are presumably know what they're talking about.
That's right.
Seems like one of those issues that really is difficult, and there really are serious pros and cons on each side.
Yeah, and you might want to lean one way. You know, your gut reaction might be, take it all away, but once you find out how many trucks, the impact on the community, you know.
And where are you going to put it?
Yeah.
And who else's community are you going to put it
in? That's right. You have to really weigh this carefully, and I think it takes some education.
Well, all of this education is available, ladies and gentlemen, for you wonderful citizens who listen to KSFR tonight. And if people would like more information, they can call 989-1662, 989-1162. And they can also go to, this is a great website, nnmcab.org. That's not that bad.
And yeah.
NorthernNewMexicoCab.org, nnmcab.org, to find out more. Lorelei Novak, anything you want to let people know before we go?
Oh, no, I just want to thank you very much for having us here today, and we really hope you, the public comes by, you know, part or all. We really want to hear from you. The board wants to hear from you.
And we will see you tonight at the Santa Fe Community College.
Thank you.
We're going to take just a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jeff Hawkins. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Dr. Jeff Hawkins. He's the director of the Department of Integrative Health Studies at Northern New Mexico College. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mayor Shara.
It's great to have you here. Now, let's talk about, integrative studies, holistic medicine, complementary, alternative, these are all terms that we hear and that we talk about. But first, let's hear a little bit about you. Your path to this whole world of integrative studies has been an interesting one, and I guess a kind of circuitous one.
A circuitous one indeed, in that I've had an opportunity, fortunately, to participate in both academic medicine as well as in, I don't know what to call it. You went through some of the terms, none of them particularly feel comfortable for me. Years back in Los Angeles, I had a private practice after finishing a residency in pediatrics at the University of Chicago, I opened a practice of considering some of the modalities that you were referring to. I called what I did at the time transitional medicine. It was a time of extreme excitement Their holistic medicine didn't exist at that time. There was no such term. It was quite pioneering and exciting to witness just isolated individuals trying to put together something out of their perceptions and I would have to say at times disappointment in the completeness and effectiveness of some forms of allopathic medicine with some problems. So I did that for 12 years. At the end of that time, I decided to do exactly the opposite, and I went and got a board certified in anesthesiology, which to me represented an opportunity to deal with acute care medicine, which is also something that appeals to me. And it's really pretty much straightforward biochemistry, physiology, and pharmacology. So when I finished that at Harvard, I returned back to California and went on staff at Scripps Hospital out at San Diego. Did that for 15 years. And last year said, I think I'm done with this. And weren't exactly sure where I felt like I could take my talents at that point. This opportunity came up at Northern New Mexico College. It was something that I looked at very carefully, very closely, considered deeply, had certain reservations, had certain positive responses. Ultimately, I took the position, and it has been pure delight from that point forward.
So, and we will talk about the program in some detail in a few minutes, but let's go back to the point in your life where you practiced what you call transitional medicine. You were an MD from really hardcore medical training. What did you then do? I mean, what were you actually practicing when people came into your office and said, I have a tummy ache or whatever?
I initially started out utilizing my pediatric background. I worked in the emergency room at Los Angeles County, which was quite an experience in and of itself. Then I began a private practice, sort of at the interface between Beverly Hills and Los Angeles proper. Did that for a short while, but I became increasingly intrigued with the idea that most of the world does not utilize the kind of methodology and treatment methods that we use in this country. Even more so at that time, which was, 30, 35 years ago. As I began to look at that, I thought, goodness, there's obviously a tremendous spectrum of problems that I'm presented with, both in a pediatric population, and I was also seeing some adults in a general practice sense. I noticed that there were applications of allopathic medicine, and by that I mean, of course, conventional medicine or whatever we want to term it.
Allopathic means you go to the doctor's office or the hospital, and that's what they're practicing there.
In this country, right.
In this country.
That's exactly right. So, there were problems that clearly they were appropriate for that approach. However, there were others where I became increasingly dissatisfied. And I thought, goodness gracious, if the rest of the world, which involves people equally as intelligent as we are, though they may, one could make an argument, say that they have less resources or less finances to look at problems, nevertheless, there they were for millennia taking care of people. And, of course, I think it's a pretty broad spread knowledge that the statistics of infant mortality, which is high in real undeveloped countries, but longevity, the U.S. doesn't really bear up that well to the rest of the country based on the amount of money we spend per capita to take care of our population. So what I did was, I said, well, let me start trying some of these methodologies. Let me try and learn some of these methodologies. That was a very impactful experience.
What did you actually learn?
Well, at that time, there was very little access to most anything. I started with the ones that had the most notoriety, such as acupuncture. At that time, there were no really acupuncture schools in that area teaching to the Anglo population. There were perhaps small schools in Chinatown or in Koreatown or various parts of the city, but I tried to learn what I could from isolated practitioners, and part of that was this curious experience of itinerant, I say itinerant, but they were in a way practitioners whose careers were both patient care and also traveling worldwide to teach people what some of the things that they knew. So people would pass through the city from Europe, from Asia, from all over the United States, and there were people there in the area, such as someone like Bernard Jensen, who was kind of a nutritionist, just basically living a healthy lifestyle. All of those were like sources to begin to consider what role does nutrition have? What role does exercise have? What role do these other methodologies have? For example, Bernard Jensen was a practitioner of iridology. I studied that because...
Iridology is...
It's said to be a reflection of systemic disorders, that is, throughout the entire body, being reflected through the iris, the colored part of the eye. So that by looking for where certain stains are, certain coloration changes, certain disruptions of the fibers, then you can, quote, make some kind of correlation with the body. For me personally, I did not necessarily resonate with that particular methodology. However, my intent was to try and look carefully and not prejudge, see what might be available there. And that's sort of I think that's the attitude that I adopt toward the department now. What I started seeing was that it is a very, very complex problem. It was one that I hoped I'd find simple one-on-one solutions, like you use acupuncture for this and you have this effect on that problem. That did not turn out to be the case. What it started to, let's use acupuncture as an example. What it started to do was, it started to bring the realization that if you want to adopt some of these methodologies, you need to perhaps think of them not simply in the linear terms that we tend to do in the West, but rather you need to move into a conceptual system which is much broader. By understanding that, then you can begin to see why certain approaches are taken to different patients. For example, as I learned some acupuncture, and I'm going to say in a very rudimentary style, even though I thought at the time, oh boy, isn't this wonderful that I'm learning these things and that I know these things. With time, of course, I realized it is at least a lifetime pursuit to gain facility in such an approach. But I begin to teach some of the things I was learning because I believed in them very deeply, and I wanted to teach physicians and nurses and chiropractors and dentists, and I begin to put on symposia and do some TV shows and things like that. What I found was, let's say with my own particular group or physicians, they came to me and what they did, and I did the same thing, but I had a little more experience than they did, so I could recognize what they were doing. They brought their previous conceptual system to the practice. So they said to me, look, I want you to teach me 5 points for, stomach ulcers. And in a certain way, and I'm going to overstate this, but in a certain way, that is not even a meaningful request in Chinese medicine, because they don't think in terms of, and again, this is an overstatement, but they don't think in terms of disease processes as we do. To them, talking about stomach ulcers, and I saw this in many traditions, it's a little bit like talking about what the score is on the scoreboard after the game is over. That's not the point of interest. The point of interest is the process, the game itself, the plays that are being carried out, the strategies that are being used to alter that score.
But at the same time, in other words, if I go into an acupuncturist, I'm going to say, I've got bad stomach ache.
Yes, and that's partly their adaptation to our side.
So, but I mean, a Chinese person, too, they'll go into the doctor and say, oh, my stomach hurts. I mean, otherwise, how would they know?
Well, what the traditional practitioner would reconceptualize the problem as far as the particular imbalance in the meridians, what was involved, what kind of traditional disruptions of, say, the spleen meridian or the stomach meridian, and it may very well turn out not to be what an association we would make. For example, low back pain, they might treat the kidney meridian, and we go, why in the world is that being done? So it got to be a question of starting to try and resonate with, perceive with, understand a little bit of what their conception was. And it opened a whole world to what this, I call it transitional medicine at the time, simply because I didn't have a phrase and because I was coming from a physician point of view towards something that was an unknown. So I just call it a transition. But it, as a social phenomenon, it became quite curious. I think the initial response was it was a little wacky, and that's totally understandable. And it's continued to evolve since that time to the current time, when I think people are starting to consider the whole approach as, oh, maybe wacky, but maybe important, and maybe there are factors we need to consider. But I think there's still kind of this overtone that somehow some of this methodology is for overindulgent people, are self-obsessed, are not dealing with their own issues. I don't believe this is true.
Well, I mean, your experience tells you it's not true.
Well, that's true. That is correct. But when you... My current interest is, I've tried to extend a little bit beyond to where maybe we're going to get to. But in the meantime, to get there, to use the department as, that's a little harsh, use the department, but to let the department explore for itself what some of the component pieces are as this model of healthcare really changes. And I started thinking, well, okay, what is different about complementary and alternative medicine, if we can use that term, just for convenience? What is different about that from what I would do as an allopath? And again, now this is a dissection of certain features of the approach, but it's a good starting point. One of the most obvious, and I would say most publicized aspects of it, is an expansion of modalities. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means instead of just using an antibiotic or just using surgery, and I don't say that in any pejorative way. I am trained as an anesthesiologist. I have seen surgery and anesthesia save lives dramatically, and it's absolutely wonderful to see those kinds of responses. However, In the modalities being offered by complementary and alternative medicine, remember the department is called the Department of Integrative Health Studies, and I take the integrative very seriously. So I want to include allopathic plus, what is this other thing? Well, here are these other modalities. So there are things like acupuncture and acupressure, herbology, nutrition, aromatherapy, body manipulation, massage, shamanism. The idea is to stay open to what they are. Now, why would these other modalities be added? Well, they're added because they come out of a different conceptual base. The base from this point of view is that disease, illness, disruption of health, out of balance, comes from a multi-dimensional causation versus and treatment, by the way, because causation, different causes, therefore different modes and different avenues to approach them, versus a more contemporary and sometimes very useful concept, which is a sort of one-on-one. This disease is a target, this medicine is a bullet, boom, and that's how you treat it. That is very, very useful for certain conditions. It is not so useful for other, and the multi the multidimensional causative model works better for other kinds of problems. There is, however, inherent in that a risk. And the risk is, and I think this is the one that gets probably the most notoriety, and should perhaps, about CAM, complementary and alternative medicine. What about these methodologies? Which ones are, quote, good? Which ones are bad? Which ones are effective? And which ones are, let's be harsh, bogus? Unfortunately, the answer is not going to be simple, and it is not going to be, it's going to vary person to person. But if one were realistic about it, you would also say that this is true even in allopathic medicine. And over many years of practicing allopathic medicine and watching my father, who was a physician, and my grandfather, who was a physician, you will see that the solutions provided by allopathic medicine are at times some good, some bad. Sometimes they have consequences you don't anticipate. In the latter part of doing anesthesia, as I said, I did it for 15 years, I started doing a lot of orthopedic surgery. And some of the simplest surgeries, like a meniscectomy where there's a torn tissue in the knee causing a great deal of pain, you operate on them, it's a fairly simple surgery, and lo and behold, the patient does dramatically better, and you go, wow, this is wonderful. However, they're now beginning to drift out 10, 15, 20 years into it, that there may be some consequences to this. Removing some of that tissue may affect the dynamics of the knee, the mechanics of the knee, and there might be longer term and more difficult problems. Now, I'm not saying people shouldn't have that surgery done by any means. Sometimes it's imperative, and some people may do well forever. But just to consider that there may be, as with all modalities, the potentiality for unexpected outcomes. So that's one aspect, the expansion of modalities. And then I thought, well, what else is different about complementary and alternative medicine? Another major component, and this is, I think, well recognized by the public, there is an emphasis on patient determination, self-determination. So what's the allopathic model? Okay, I'm going to be, what do you call it? I'm going to abstract this, and I'm going to be oversimplify it. It's like you have a problem, you go to the expert, you go to the specialist gives you the answer, and bingo, you're happy. And sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's not. So in complementary and alternative medicine, it tries to turn a little bit away from that toward patient self-determination. Now, like with the first factor, there's a downside. What's the downside? The downside is there may be a significant component of patient confusion, fear, disorientation. It's like, hey, don't tell me I came to you to fix the problem. Don't tell me I have to do it. What is the solution to that so that you can still reap the benefits of bringing back the element of self-determination? And I think the possibility there, and this is going to be a little abstract, but it's a critical principle, and that is to honor the self-destiny and self-truth of the person. You go, yeah, right. What does that mean? What it means is, and now we're moving into some little kind of more deeper waters on this thing, but it gets curious, and it starts to bring out the other aspects of it, that there may indeed be a possibility that some health problems are results of self-violations. Now, it can be anything from as gross as eating fast food as your exclusive diet, which is probably not a good idea, or it could be something more subtle like, a bad relationship or marriage. Now, but remember, because it's multi-causative, there are multi ways of treating it. That doesn't mean you have to be out of the marriage. It just means let's include in your telling me and elaborating your problem what some of the factors might be.
We're talking to Jeff Hawkins. He is the director of the Department of Integrative Studies at Northern New Mexico College. Well, one of the things that, you know, in this whole conversation about holistic medicine that drives me kind of crazy is when people say, you cause your own illness. That's, you know, that's a little hard to take sometimes.
I'll tell you, I think that is, I'm so much in agreement with you. I think that is such a destructive statement. It's something that any practitioner probably goes through a phase of. You might see somebody come in and you see, it's so obvious what they're, quote, doing to themselves, and they, let's say, a smoker or something, that you need to, you get frustrated and you go, you're doing this. But what has come clear to me over decades of doing this is that that serves very little to no purpose. And if your orientation is truly healing, you must move back and expand enough to include the whole of the entity. Now, this also opens a very interesting question. Why some people do very well with certain adverse stimuli and others don't? Why do some smokers do, I wouldn't say fine exactly, but they do relatively well, and others develop lung cancer? When I was in medical school or residency or beyond, there was always the thing of, okay, well, look, they're viruses, they're bacteria. Yeah, I agree. But my interest from very, very early on, when the flu season came, I wasn't quite as interested in the people who got the flu as the ones who didn't. Like, well, why in the world did that happen?
Well, what did you come up with? That's a very interesting question. Did you come to any conclusions?
Well, I came to a lot of conclusions, and the conclusions were that it is a very, lady here who you had on for the 5 minutes with the waste disposal. It's a difficult situation, whether to cover it, whether to excavate it. It's the same with your own health care. I think that the approach must be individualized.
No. But the question of why did some people not get the flu? What kind of conclusions did you come up with, if any?
Oh, you're asking a very big question.
Well, you brought it up.
Done. It can be anything from psychological. It can be dietary. It can be previous patterns. I'm getting ready. The college is getting ready to send me to India to do some maybe set up some exchange programs there with Ayurveda or homeopathy or yogic therapy, a particular love of mine. And my wife is very concerned. Oh my God, you're going to go and you're going to do this up in the Himalayas and you're going to be sick. Another good friend of mine said, you know, instead of taking a whole bunch of medications and this and that with you and herbs, just her experience in going to India multiple times over 30 years was learn to laugh. And that's part of the answer too. My hesitation about responding to you is because I don't want to make it sound like there's any one factor that makes the difference.
Well, what are the top five, do you think? Okay, laughing. Somebody who laughs all day is healthy. I laugh all day. I'm fragile. I get sick all the time.
That's true. But there is, I think, one, if I was going to say a major difference, and again, it's not something I really feel that all that comfortable saying, but I would say good nutrition makes a big difference. I would say exercise makes a big difference. I would say good sleep makes a big difference. I would say mental attitude, happiness, contentment makes a big difference. And most importantly, I would say self-understanding, self-engagement makes a critical, critical difference. And that self-engagement, and this is now precipitated us a little bit off the edge of the cliff, but looking back over years, when I I'm going to give you two perspectives. One was when I concluded with holistic medicine after 12 years, way back when, and my current perspective. At the end of 12 years, people said, well, what did you learn in 12 years? It's sort of a variation of the question you're asking right now. And I said, what I learned was, number one, it's a bigger ball game than we think it is, which is pretty vague, but that's what I walked away with. And the second was, it's the mind. But when I say it's the mind, I don't mean that in a derogatory way or in a constrictive way or in a denying way. The mind is engaged by many, many things. Now, as I look at problems and the very question you're asking, I would say something, and this takes time to be with someone, perhaps, to share some of this understanding, but I believe that a lot of disruption I've certainly seen it in my own life and in the lives of many patients is a denial of oneself truth. And you say, my God, what in the world is that? Well, what that is something that changes all the time. Once we become more and more sensitive to our own inner self, inner awareness, inner consciousness, inner guidance, outside of our own abstractions, which we apply all the time, you will feel in your gut what's good, what's bad. And I think that that's probably the critical factor. A person living in that way just doesn't have the problem, has much less problems. Illness, disease, imbalances are multifactorial. Yes, they can be affected by direct material things, whether it's diet or bacteria or viruses. But all we're looking to do is not to take a position, in the department, is not to take a position on that, but simply to say, are there additional ways we can look at strengthening a person's immune system so that when they go through the flu season, they might fare a little better or not.
We're talking to Jeff Hawkins, and he's the director of the Department of Integrative Health Studies at Northern New Mexico University, and that is a four-year college degree program. People at the end get a Bachelor of Science, is that correct?
That's right. It is structured as a Bachelor of Science, and I think we're the only program fully accredited four-year program on a baccalaureate level in the country, so that people can have enough science to understand some of the research around complementary and alternative medicine. You're required to have a couple of semesters of anatomy, physiology, chemistry, biochemistry, statistics, simple. These are not overly challenging, but they're there enough to provide you with an armamentarium to look at these things. Then you complete the program, a four-year program, and we have in process a master's program to further develop that. Oh, and by the way, interestingly enough, there is one master's program in the country, and that's at Georgetown University back in Washington, D.C., but it was a overflow from the medical school. It is very, I think it's a great program. It's very, very academically and research oriented, which we have an interest in the department, but not to the exclusion of making sure that people get training in the modalities so that they can explore them and that they can utilize them. In addition, we're going to be offering certification programs. For example, in homeopathy, the completion of which would allow one to take the national exam for homeopathy and become licensed.
Well, that's a question that I had. When people get out of your four-year program, what are they ready to do professionally? Or is it just like, doing pre-med, then you can go on and study something else afterwards?
That was certainly one of the components of it, that it would be a pre-professional training for people who want to go to chiropractic school or acupuncture school or medical school or dental school or nursing school. We have quite a few nurses take courses. That was the initial concept. There is a growing interest and awareness and need for people who have skills in these fields. At the hospitals, we are currently working with St. Vincent's here, and also with Holy Cross up in Taos. there is a need to integrate some of these technologies into already existing medical structures. So there would be another place a person could go. They could go in to help set these up, to participate in and provide those kind of services. They could take existing talents that they learn, say with homeopathy or nutrition or aromatherapy, and they could take that into the setting of someone's private practice and work under their license. They could, certain of the modalities can be used alone. Nutrition, acupressure, you do not have to be licensed for. There are also some potential legislative changes that are going to happen in New Mexico in 2009, which may allow additional freedom for practitioners to utilize various modalities with the state's sanction. So that would be another thing people could do with them. I have also seen, since our program, it became a four-year program September 1st of last year, I have seen a rapid change in the students who came initially only to learn a certain methodology, which is a very valid approach, but who have now expanded out into a greater awareness of what the field might be. My own sense is that there is going to be created a new breed of practitioner, I don't know what it might be called, an integrative health practitioner, that will become recognized as freestanding in and of itself. You could also go into spas and utilize these things in various settings. You could also go into administrative positions, or some of the students now are very interested in teaching positions, teaching the same field that they've been learning.
You know, one of the things that I think is a problem in allopathic medicine is diagnosis. You go in with some problem and they want to send you to a specialist and have it be localized. When you talk about, for example, the Chinese acupuncture paradigm, that's like looking at the body as a whole system and so on, which is a completely different approach. How do you teach when you're working with so many different methods? How do you teach an integrated system of diagnostics?
That's a very good question. And we're in an incredible transition phase. My own sense is, again, I take the integrative aspect of it very, very seriously. And it is a paramount responsibility of any practitioner to recognize certain conditions which should not be treated by alternative methods. So you must be able to recognize acute appendicitis or something like that, where you want to be extremely careful to pursue any other path than what needs to be done in an immediate way. So the diagnosis, we do teach 2 semesters of pathophysiology, which is to understand the body from a traditional Western point of view and to hear the major alarm signals when you hear a person talk or when you do a physical exam on them that tells you this is something that needs to be looked at acutely and immediately. Once that's done, then you need to begin to participate in that diagnostic process. As it stands right now, many times the patients are people who have already been previously diagnosed, often with quote, chronic diseases, diseases that evolve over a long period of time, and out of frustration of not getting the kind of resolution or results they want, they're attempting to do other modalities. Now, there's a perfect place to begin to look at the body and the system in different ways using different systems. I, for myself, as administrator of the program, will not take a position on supporting any one modality. I believe that there is inherent in many, many modalities the ability to utilize its own form of diagnosis to sense what an imbalance might be and how that imbalance might be corrected using whether it's herbs or homeopathy or whatever.
We're talking to Jeff Hawkins. Let's look at some actual examples of places where you've got a patient coming in, and the process you might go through. I mean, maybe something, you know, obviously there's confidentiality, but just an example where you were able to use a non-allopathic remedy to best treat the problem.
Well, most of the examples of that would be pretty mundane. People who come in with osteoarthritis, for example, with a lot of pain, and utilizing diet and movement and herbs, or over a period of time to see an improvement, because there is in the very nature of not always, but many times with complementary and alternative medicine, the process tends to be a little more longitudinal than in conventional medicine. Conventional medicine,
meaning it takes longer to work.
Right. Well, may take longer to work or not, but in conventional medicine, it's like you have pneumonia, here's the antibiotic that treats it, and sometimes that's a very appropriate thing to do. But at other times, it may be that over a period of time, the person simply gets better. They improve. Now, the usual response to that is, well, they would have gotten better anyway. And that might be true, or it might not. It seems less that would be true in people who have had chronic disease established for, 15 years. And all of a sudden, why over a period of 3 months should they get better? But I think, from my stance, it's not about who did what. And I guess that's my love of medicine, is either the patient gets better or they don't. Now, that doesn't mean we don't stop investigating, we don't stop exploring, we don't stop experimenting to find out what might be the causative factors. But the really critical factor is, do they get better? I could give you examples of people who had very dramatic and even, I would say, controversial responses or healings. I don't like to talk about those too much because they're a little too sensational, and they tend to get branded as spontaneous remissions or the original diagnosis was wrong.
Well, that's one of those things that from just a purely logical point of view drives you crazy, is that when an allopathic doctor gives you penicillin and you get better, they say it's the penicillin, and then when an acupuncturist gives you Chinese herbs and you get better, you say it's the placebo effect.
I just love the placebo effect. That's my favorite thing. And I got to say, one of the major modes major factors that got me into looking at this, when I was in medical school, and this was a while back, we were taught that 40% of everything you do is placebo. Now, what does that mean? That means that 40% of the time, if you do the wrong thing repeatedly, the patient's still going to get better. At that time, when I was in medical school, the response of myself and other physicians in training was, you were insulted by this. How dare they get better despite the fact that you've done everything wrong? Whereas in reality, they're the people with the power. What happened then? You didn't give them an herb. You didn't stick them with an acupuncture needle. But all of a sudden, they recovered. And that's been one of the motivating factors in getting me to keep looking at this whole phenomena of what healing is, because it does begin to raise the issue of what is healing.
Well, and unfortunately, we should have started with that. It's actually time to go. We'll have to do part two of this conversation another time. Dr. Jeff Hawkins is the director of the Department of Integrative Studies at Northern New Mexico College, and the website over there is nnmc.edu, and the phone numbers over there are 747-2220 and 747-2256. Dr. Hawkins, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can also, we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's own .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I want to thank Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.